First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, welcome to the BS Report. We have an action-packed podcast for you today. Coming up a little bit later, former GM of the Raiders and the Browns, Mike Lombardi. He's going to talk about the NFL draft with us. And as always, my buddy Jacko, diehard Yankee fan. We're going to call him at work and see how concerned he is about this Yankees-Red Sox season. But first, once upon a time, the prince of ESPN and now the lead guy on the NFL Network, as well as the lead candidate for the Democratic Party in 2008, Mr. Rich Eisen.
Thank you very much, Bill.
What's happening?
Actually, I view myself as the frog of ESPN and now the prince of the National Football League's network.
This is an emotional homecoming for you, this podcast.
It is. It is. First time I've been on ESPN.com. On the front page of ESPN.com in quite some time.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just shows you, and everyone, the power of the sports guy.
Thank you.
To be able to wield whatever you wield to get this done.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, when you left, I remember there was that emotional Jeff Buckley video, the last goodbye.
Yep.
Just scenes, 5 minutes of you cracking wise on SportsCenter.
Yeah.
I remember getting teared up.
Yeah, I remember that too.
You know, you look back and you lived in Bristol.
Yes, I did.
And now you live in Los Angeles.
I do.
I'm going to say that's better.
That would be considered an upgrade in many people's eyes. Yes.
Many, not all, but many.
Not, you know what? That's true. But, you know, it's crazy. I'm coming up my 5-year anniversary of my final SportsCenter. Coming up 5 years.
I read about it in Sports Illustrated this week. They had a big feature on it.
I must have missed that issue.
Yeah,
must have missed that issue. Yeah, it's been 5 years since I last played Fact or Fiction for real, like on the record. You know what I mean?
But you still play it in your home life.
I do, just you know, to continue. And I have somebody play it, a Salisbury character, even though you know he's gone too. Who's still there, Bill? Who's still there? Anybody?
A lot of people are still there. Yeah. It's a new breed, new genre.
Fantastic.
We have this new building opening up in Los Angeles, though.
I know, right across the street from Staples Center.
It could be time for a Rich Eisen comeback. Round two.
Yeah.
It's going to be a nice location.
I couldn't believe that ESPN is going to open up something in Los Angeles. I can't believe the umbilical cord goes that far.
It does.
You know.
And that's what's actually taken so long to build the building is that they actually had to build an umbilical cord that went from...
It lasted that long. And
yeah,
they had to build it on the ground. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know how many Hartford to Los Angeles direct flights there are anymore. There used to be some back when I did it.
Well, you know what? I'm going to say it's worked out for you because the NFL Network, although I currently don't get it because I have Time Warner.
Unbelievable.
The NFL Network.
Didn't you used to get it?
Well, I have DirecTV, but we moved, and we can't get DirecTV with this new house I have, so we're going to have to figure out what I'm going to do. Basically, I don't know what I'm going to end up doing, but it will definitely be illegal.
Well, what you can do also is, the invite always is there for you to come down to the NFL Network studios in Culver City and watch the games with us. And
I tried that once, but my electronic tracking bracelet went off, and I was getting electrocuted. I just couldn't
do it. You went outside the radius, did you?
I got within 50 feet of the building, and all of a sudden I just fell down. I was just in convulsions.
We don't need that anymore. But the option still stands to come to our studio. We watch 9 games at once, sometimes 10 or 11.
I appreciate that. And also, the difference between that and Jimmy's house is that it's a more multi-ethnic atmosphere.
I keep forgetting
than Jimmy's house.
Every time I invite you or Cousin Sal, I even invited Jimmy one time. I keep forgetting anybody who goes to Kimmel's house on Sundays doesn't need to come to NFL Network because it's basically, you know, we don't have a tap there. We don't have anything of that sort at
we
the
have
NFL Network.
Food, so like hors d'oeuvres.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, we do have that.
No, we've got hors d'oeuvres.
Oh.
We've got food. We've got a schmear, a spread, but there's no tap. There's nothing on tap at all. You know, and I know he's got a cool soda fountain, too. He's got that. We don't have that. We don't have that either.
I'll tell you one thing. There's a lot of concern about Kimmel's house this year because
why?
He's become more famous because of these YouTube videos.
Right.
Now he runs with the likes of Ben Affleck.
Yeah.
Dax Shepard he hangs out with.
Is that right?
Hanging out with Woody Harrelson. So there's a lot of concern about a potential red rope type of thing
for
the football season, where like only the celebs will be allowed in the living room.
Oh my!
Everybody
goodness.
Else will be herded into the kitchen.
I don't believe that I don't believe that for a second.
I don't know.
I'm gonna have to see it to believe that.
Fame changes people, Rich.
Oh, wow.
It really does. Anyway, back to the NFL Network.
Yes, sir.
Which I still don't get, but hopefully I'll get. I'll have to break a lot, but I will get it. It is a fantastic channel.
Thank you.
And not only that, but you guys have really kind of evolved into a monolith almost. Like, I have a feeling like in 2018, every NFL game will be on the NFL Network.
That's never going to happen, though, to be very
honest. No?
No, that'll never happen. That'll never happen.
I'm relieved.
The economic model of the NFL is built on most games on free television. And, everybody, it's the Sunday ticket. That's why you've got to get your DirecTV.
I know.
You've got to get your Sunday ticket. You've got to see every game.
There's something not constitutional about the Sunday ticket.
Why?
Well, because I need to order from a specific company to get it. Like,
right.
How is that not I don't want to say monopoly, but they're like.
Well, but here's for you and your listeners and readers and all that good stuff about this is the crux of the issue of the reason why we're not fully distributed is Sunday Ticket, I believe.
Hmm.
And because the cable companies all want it. And the two reasons why the cable companies have yet to get it. The NFL has not awarded it to these cable companies is twofold. One, I mentioned the economic model is free television. So CBS and Fox pay quite a premium rate to broadcast, regionally all these games from coast to coast. And if they didn't have the guarantee that they can have people's eyeballs on the advertisers, they wouldn't be able to afford these rights fees.
Yes.
So if Sunday Ticket was available to, say, 100 million households, CBS and Fox would have an issue telling their advertisers, no, don't worry. As soon as there's a commercial, no one's going to flip around to another game. They're going to sit there and watch your Taco Bell commercial. That's a tough sell.
Yeah.
Secondly, if the league did want to go ahead and try and figure out how to get around all that, how to make everybody happy, I'm told that the cable companies are trying to do Sunday Ticket a la carte, the way that the ESPN game plan is. That if you want Titans against the Texans, that's $8.95. If you want the Jets against the Dolphins, that's another $8.95, as opposed to the way DirecTV does it, which is charging a couple $100 flat rate or whatever if HD is more at the beginning of the season, you get every game. And the league doesn't want to do that. So that's the long and the short of it right there.
That was incredibly factual.
Thank you.
In fact, you sounded like almost like a politician. I feel like I actually had Obama on.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That was good, though. Fans in small towns who don't get Sunday Ticket are very bitter.
Is this that's the number one question that you get from the common folk?
I do. Is how come I don't get your network, which drives me a little crazy.
Right.
It's
got to be a little frustrating for you not to be seen.
Of course it is. Well,
people.
It's frustrating, to go ahead and do all this great television that you've been kind to mention and, have people say, I wish I could get it. I can't get it for various reasons. I got cable or I'd love to get DirecTV, but I got a tree in the way, and to have that as the issue as to why they don't get to see all this stuff. It can be frustrating, but nobody sits around in a production meeting saying, boy, we got a great show today. It's too bad. Only 38 million homes are going to see it.
Right.
No one
says
that.
I remember the last three or four times I've run into you. Which, we were in our therapy group together, Playboy Mansion.
Yes, indeed.
Then I think it won Super Bowl or whatever. Mm-hmm. Each time I've mentioned to you how upset I was that they didn't show enough old games and that it was like the same two games over and over again.
Right.
This season, the 2007 season, all of a sudden they dipped into the library. It was fantastic.
Yeah, it was good stuff.
And especially not just the old games, but they were also like if it was, I don't know, Patriots-Jets. They'd show, the best five Patriots-Jets games ever. I just thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, there's good stuff, and I'm still hoping that someday, because I'm told it's the Howard Cosell estate that prevents it from happening, is Monday Night Football games. Bring them all back. Let's see the night that, John Lennon and Ronald Reagan go into the booth at the same game. Apparently, Howard Cosell's estate is blocking it, that he didn't want his voice used. In any way, shape, or form. I think it would be great. And in the offseason, I still have Monday Night Football, but just show old Monday Night games. Plus, I also like seeing, it's amazing. I saw the Super Bowl between the Giants and the Bills the other day on our network. And you're, freaked out because you don't know the score. It's not in the top part of your screen that, I mean, I've become so ingrained to know not only how much time is left, what the score is, but how much is left on the game clock, you know, until you have to snap the ball. I mean, we're totally spoiled when it comes to that now. It's great just seeing how uncluttered screens used to be with all this stuff.
Yeah, in some ways I kind of liked it more back then because I had the same reaction. I watched that Bills-Giants game. I watched they showed one from the 80s, like in the late 80s, that I remember really enjoying.
I think it was the Bengals and the Niners.
Yeah. The lack of graphics I liked, a clean, nice clean screen.
Mm-hmm.
Could see all the players and only like a couple replays.
Which guy are you not worn out by? Like, which announcer are you like, this is the...
You mean other than Gus Johnson?
You gotta love Gus Johnson. I mean,
gotta love Gus.
Even, you know, a 3 yard in a cloud of dust run to Gus Johnson, it's like Valparaiso just won the first round all over again.
I'll tell you, I was watching, Fox Sportsnet, they had like the 50 greatest baseball plays, and they showed the Sid Bream scoring the winning run. Sean McDonough's call on that, I think, is the single greatest call I've ever heard in any game. Do you remember that?
Around.
His voice cracks. He goes, he is safe! Like, it goes like 15 different octaves and cracks. And it's like, Gus needs to top that, I think, for his next.
Who's the guy the Red Sox hired who sounds just like him? The guy
who sounds like Don Orsillo.
He sounds just like him. It's frightening.
Yeah, it's like they cloned him. He's a nice guy, but it is like you would think if you were on Lost, you're on the Lost Island for 6 years and you came back, you would think
you
it
would
was
think,
Sean McDonough.
Yes, you would think that.
Hey, speaking of announcers, does that mean, Gumbel's out for NFL Network?
Yes.
Did you throw your hat in the ring?
Oh, 100%.
That'd be a nice move for you.
Listen, should I give you the political answer? Do you want
yes.
the political answer?
Give me the political
I'm
answer.
I'm just happy doing whatever I can do for NFL Network. You know, these games are very important to the network and they've been really fun to do. And I love being with Dion and Marshall and Steve. On the set before and after the game and halftime, and that's been exciting to do, and I'm looking forward to this season.
All right, give us the personal answer.
I want to do it! In the worst way!
Especially with Collinsworth. That, you guys would be my new favorite team.
I would love
I'm
to
not
do
just
it.
Blowing smoke
I
up your
listen,
butt.
Listen, I called the couple Senior Bowls the last two Januaries, and that is not, I mean, it's a tough job. It is an unbelievably tough job calling games and, you know, trying to, bring in your announcer and make it all salient to somebody sitting at home. And then that game at the Senior Bowl, I don't even know half the players, I'll be very honest with you. You know, I mean, paying attention to pro football all year long.
Yeah.
Half these guys I don't know, and then I have to figure them out on the fly right during the middle of the playoffs, and then they come in and out of the game, and you have no idea who's substituted for who. And at any rate, I loved doing it. I called.
It was a challenge.
That's great. It's phenomenal. I called
you're good at
baseball
hosting.
Games at ESPN when I was there, and I loved doing it. It's so much fun calling games.
Now, would you agree
that
there are different skill sets for a studio host and a play-by-play announcer?
100%, of course.
Right. Because we've seen over the years, we've seen different TV networks. I won't name them, and I won't name the guys they hired, but you can pretty easily figure it out. Mm-hmm. Just say, hey, here's a big name. Let's make him our lead play-by-play guy.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time it doesn't work.
You know what the toughest thing is calling play-by-play?
Yeah.
100%. Toughest thing is shutting up. It's so tough. It is so difficult to just shut up, you know, when you're calling the game.
You just want to ramble and ramble and ramble.
It's really tough. You know, that's why one of the many reasons why I love Joe Buck, you know. And, you know, Summerall. You know, you listen to Pat Summerall, just speaking about old games, just listen to Summerall, it's just like, or Joe Buck's call of the touchdown to beat your beloved Patriots. I'm sorry to bring it up.
Yeah.
But basically it's like Manning, end zone, Burris, touchdown. I mean, that's all you really need, because you're seeing the rest of it.
I thought Buck could have gotten a little more excited for the helmet catch.
You think so?
And by a little, I mean any level of excitement.
But
would have been better.
Sometimes you're just so surprised by it, and that's another great marker. That's why, to me, John Miller is John Miller is the best baseball announcer.
Mm-hmm.
If you hear his call of the Jeffrey Mayer moment out in right field at Yankee Stadium, I mean, who's going to think, you know, that, and he called it on radio, so you have to be terribly descriptive, obviously. And he, you know, who's going to suspect, you know, an 11-year-old kid leaning over the right field fence to steal a ball from Tony Tarasco and then have the, you know, the umpire was at, I forget who it was, oh gosh, but at any rate,
Tony Tarasco, I think it was.
Yeah, after Rich Garcia, that's who it was. Rich Garcia, they call it a home run. He's on top of it, and he's excited the whole time, and he nailed it. I mean, who expected Manning to get away, and then who expected that to really be a catch? Sometimes you have to, like, pause to see, was it a catch, was it not? You don't want to say, oh, it's a catch, and then, no, it's not. You know, I mean, so sometimes it can make you hesitant. It's really a tough gig. It's very difficult to do. And, you know, that's why I guess it's a challenge. But it's very exciting to be at these events, certainly when you're sitting in a studio most of the time, you know.
Would you have to get different clothes, you think? Because right now you're rolling with Armani and Zegna.
Yeah, I'm rolling with the Zegna, the Canali. I'm doing that. I'm doing all
Canali.
Sorts of time. Oh, yeah. I'm rolling with that. That's the way I roll. But I would
play
roll
by
the
play.
Same way. I'd roll the same way.
Yeah?
Yeah, sure. I would not wear pants, though. I mean, because sometimes in the studio you have to wear pants. I would probably not wear pants. That might be, you know,
you didn't wear pants. You never wore pants on SportsCenter, which a lot of people didn't know.
Actually, there were a couple times when I did wear shorts, you know, or you'd wear jeans. You know, that was the Kilbourne thing. Kilbourne always showed up without suit pants. He would just wear jeans because you'd sit behind the SportsCenter desk. Now they make you get up, stand around, walk around, jump all over the place.
Oh, that is true.
So now, you know, you have to, so there would be, sometimes they'd make you start, I was there at SportsCenter where they first started making the anchors stand. So the producer would say, we're going to make you stand up for that lead-in. So I'd say, so I need to put on pants. And the producer would say, yes, it's a pants night. That's the way it used to be. I'm giving you a little behind-the-scenes stuff.
Well, I remember when I visited our friend Gus when you were working there.
Indeed.
In like 97. The two things I was amazed by was that one of the 11 o'clock anchors was wearing blue jeans, which,
right,
you know, makes sense when you think about it because you never see the pants.
Overman always wore jeans.
Right.
Always.
And then the other thing was that I never knew this, but Charlie Steiner was just a torso. He was just, he had two arms and a torso,
sort
and they
like
would just
the
prop
Captain
him up.
Pike of SportsCenter?
Yeah, they just propped him up. He was like Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump. They just propped him up on the stool, and that was it.
And I saw him the other day, you know, because he calls Dodger games now. On the field, he looked just fine. So you're saying he's got the magic legs.
He got the prosthetic legs, yeah. But at the time, it was deeply kept secret.
Oh, my goodness.
By ESPN. So what do you miss what do you miss most about the Worldwide Leader?
Should I give you the political answer or the non-political answer?
Political.
Okay. I miss working with all the people and all the great friends that I met there. And
you did make some good friends.
I did. That is true. That is true. You know, I mean, if it was the show that I did for the first 4 years that I was at ESPN, I'd be missing the show a lot more than I do. I don't miss not talking about all sports. I'm still a fan of them. I don't need to be talking about them to still be a fan of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just, I loved, you know, being there and being part of SportsCenter when, you know, Dan and Keith were there and Kilbourne and, you know, Charlie and Robin Roberts and Bob Lee were doing the 6 o'clock show and guys like Gus Ramsey you're referring to were producing the show and it was awesome. I think I was the only SportsCenter anchor who complained about the bottom line when they started first putting that on ESPN.
Oh.
Because I'd be doing a lead-in on Tiger Woods' comeback at the Doral, for instance, and I would be fashioning the lead-in in a way that, you know, the old SportsCenter lead-in, which is you're assuming that people didn't know the result, and you'd be building some sort of drama with a little bit of a wink and a nod. And as I'm doing that, right at the bottom line, I would say, Tiger Woods comes back from 7 strokes down to win the Doral. I'm like, well, what am I doing then, you know?
I'm going to defend the bottom line, though, because
many people. Listen, I told you I was the only one.
Well, no, but here's. I think it's the sports climate is different than it was 10 years ago.
Absolutely,
because you know, when something happens, you know right away, or you can find out right away.
That's why I think local sports are going thing of the past. Because I mean, everybody pretty much knows from either ESPN or ESPN.com, or of course, when you're talking NFL, the NFL Network. I mean, people know already, so it's very difficult to not know. So that's why I guess SportsCenter has to change too, you know.
I never knew what Kilbourne was going to say. You know, I didn't know if he'd been – this is before I really got to know him, but when sometimes those late SportsCenters, I didn't know if the guys had been like having a six-pack before they went on.
Well, that's,
just didn't know.
That's the whole aspect. That when I first got to ESPN, that's what you know, John Walsh would always say to us is that he wants the SportsCenter anchor to be the type of person that the fan wanted to have a beer with, you know. And that's the thing that I loved about doing that show. And, you're right. Things do change, and things have changed. And
I still think there's some anchors who fit that qualification.
Oh, no question about it. And SportsCenter is still, you know, the place to go. Where
I'm not doing the devil's advocate. I'm just saying.
No, and I understand. It's just like if something happens, you know, like I heard about the Sean Avery thing in front of Martin Brodeur, the first thing I did was turn on ESPN. Because, you know, SportsCenter is always going to be a slick, well-produced show that if something happens in any sport, you know they're going to get a video of it and they're going to show it. And it's just, you know, it's just the way it is. And being a part of that for 7 years was awesome. I loved it.
Hey, when you showed up, you were originally a former stand-up comic.
Correct.
And then how many years did you do TV before ESPN hired you?
Oh, gosh, only about 16 months. That's it.
I went to Redding,
California.
What city was it?
Redding, California, KRCR Television.
So they plucked you from Redding, California, and
they
was
did.
I
was the real dream job winner. I mean, going from Market 132, talking to, you know, with my 3/4-inch camera, running all over Northern California, shooting girls' volleyball matches at 9:30 at night in the middle of a very small town, and then suddenly ESPN calling me up and wanting to hire me. And then suddenly I look in the newsroom and there's Chris Berman, there's Dan and Keith and all these people that I've watched for years and emulated and wanted to, you know, would kill to have worked with. And suddenly I was.
Well, what's really disturbing about that girls' volleyball story is that you actually weren't doing that for your newscast. You just brought the camera and taped the games. I think that was it.
You got me. So
I'm glad that never came out
on this podcast. How long are your interviews normally?
You want to get rid of me?
No,
we're wrapping it up. I'm letting you go.
No, not at all. You got to
study the draft. That's right.
That's right.
There's some third rounders. You're not sure of yet.
Yes. You know what my studying for the draft is? I look in the mirror and I'm like, so tell me about this guy, Mike Mayock. That's what I do.
You don't feel a need to be overly prepared on the top 150 guys?
No, because the guys who are the experts at it, like Charles Davis and Mike Mayock and Marshall Faulk, is locked in too, very, very well. And Mariucci's going to be with me, and you know, Dion is going to be down on the floor, but Jamie Dukes is going to be there too. And you know, it's exciting. Me growing up in New York City to be hosting an NFL draft at Radio City, you know, and I look to my left and it's like there's ESPN with Berman and everybody else. It's an exciting time to be, you know, associated with the NFL right now.
Especially with the Jets having a top six pick. That pushes it over.
The Jets are on the clock. Those are the best words in Radio City Music Hall for a draft. There's no question. You just everything gets ratcheted up. You hear the buzz, and then no matter what the pick is, the Giants fans start razzing the Jets. Even if it's the greatest pick of all time, they just get right on them.
Do you get threatened at all by Mariucci's handsomeness?
He is, in fact, he's dreamy. But, you know, that's just, I can deal with it.
You've dealt with it?
He is dreamy. The chicks dig mooch.
Who's your draft crew that's going? You and Mariucci.
It'll be
Marshall
me and Mariucci and Marshall and Mike Mayock on the main set.
Yeah.
With Dion and Jamie Dukes down on the floor.
Okay.
And that's it? That's in Adam Schefter getting all the scoops.
That's only seven people. Why don't you have 27? That's the new rule.
What's your rule? I read about your rule. What's your rule? What's the maximum?
My rule is four.
Right.
Four of anything is the highest you should get.
We're keeping it at four on the set.
That's good. That makes me happy.
Right. So
yeah, four is good.
Staying within the Simmons rule.
You know what? Actually, after I wrote that column about pregame shows, I think a couple weeks later they had some debate at CNN, or maybe it was a couple months later, and they had two rows of panels of analysts after the debate, which I'd never seen before, almost like an auction.
Unbelievable.
And maybe that's where this
sounds
is going.
Like a telethon. You're right.
Yeah. So after the draft, what happens? You take like a month and a half off?
I do take a week off.
A week? That's it?
That's it. I'm going to take a week off.
Why not more?
I don't know. I don't know. It's a good question. Maybe I should take more. I don't know. I'm ready to roll. A week is enough for me.
Maybe do this. You say, I'm taking a week off, and if I don't get an answer on that Gumbel job, it's going to be 2 weeks, and it might
actually,
even be three.
I do have jury duty coming up, so.
Yeah, that's good, because nobody's ever going to challenge jury duty if it's like a protest.
Right.
Just throw it out. It's like saying that, like, you have pneumonia. It's not like they're going to call the hospital to make sure you have it.
So, watch it. Just my luck. The Pelicano jury will have a mistrial, and I'll get stuck on the next one. That'll happen to me.
Have you ever been on an L.A. jury?
I have not.
I haven't either. I shouldn't even say that. Yeah, I've been on three of them. I haven't been on one since I moved out. I'm worried I'm going to get the call soon.
Well, from what I'm told from all my friends, you sit there and you listen to everything and you just acquit the person anyway, right?
Yeah, it's a good system.
not guilty.
Good judicial system.
Yeah, that's it.
Hey, will you come on a little more frequently?
Anytime. It's the first time you've asked me. And
I know. You know, and
within 24 hours, I came on, right?
And it's a tragedy that it was the first time I asked you. You should have been in the initial rotation. I don't know what I was.
Well,
it was one of those things that it's like you're on another network, and then it's like, well, we get along. Like, why can't we?
We're above that.
Yeah.
We're above that.
Why can't, like, you know, Conan comes on Letterman show every once in a while, does he?
I think so.
And those guys make $100 million more than we do. So at the very least,
we're more down earth. I agree with you.
All right, well, enjoy the draft. Do you have give me one, so this sounds like at least it was somewhat...
Yes, you want a nugget?
Give me one nugget and one prediction for the draft.
I say Darren McFadden drops far enough where the Cowboys trade up to get him.
Ooh.
How's that little nugget?
I like it. I like it.
And then what else? What else do I miss?
The prediction. Well, that was kind of technically a prediction.
Jake Long goes number one overall. That's my prediction. How's that?
Jake Long... parentheses, not Howie Long's son, that's the other guy.
That's correct, the other Long. I think Jake goes number one overall.
I mean, really? We had to have two Longs in the top seven?
It's gonna
be dad is like, he just can't figure it out.
Well, I'm already figuring out if they do go one and two, do I say it's a long start to an already, or it's an already long day here at the draft? I mean, help me out with that one. What do I do?
I think what you do is you don't do one pun. I think you make it a running joke and
piling
see how
it
long
on.
You can milk it. Yeah, I think you do like 10 or 12.
You know, the commissioner took time off the first round, and it's still a long day.
Yes.
Like that?
You just keep, but you keep coming up with them to the point that Marshall Faulk is like disgusted. And he's ready to walk off the set. And then you do two more after that.
A done deal, Bill.
Done deal. All right, good luck to you. And we'll have you back because
anytime.
I love talking to you. All right,
yeah,
take care.
You. All right, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, let's get to our second guest, longtime GM of the Raiders and the Browns. He writes for SI.com, and he appears in the NFL Network. Mike Lombardi, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Bill.
So exciting to have you on.
Yeah, this is a big thrill in my house. I know that.
It's a big thrill in your house? That's good.
Yeah.
Hey, you just wrote an article about mock drafts for another website that's not ESPN. You know what? I'm not giving them a plug. I don't care if you write for them. It was interesting, though. Your thing was about how mock drafts actually affect the preparation of teams. Do you still think that's the case these days, or is that something that happened back in the 1980s?
No, I mean, I'm not that old, but I think it happens more today than ever because I think the media outlets are so strong and there's so much information and content that everybody's throwing names and mocks around. Back when I wrote, when I talked about the story that I wrote in 84 when we drafted Jerry Rice, you know, there was, you know, to get the Boston Globe and Willie McDonough's column, I had to call my college roommate who lived in Waltham to get it. And he called it, he gave it to me at 3:30 in the morning. He made him run out to get it. So, today you can just pick up and you could probably, you know, you can be in Zimbabwe and get 25 mock drafts.
You wrote the column for SportsIllustrated.com. I'll give you the plug because.
Thank you.
Because you're my man. but it was very interesting. The other thing that fascinates me about this whole thing is how people every year seem to believe, like, you know, they leak stuff to writers, reporters, whatever. And the people print that, like, that's what's going to happen. And then it's like a complete swerve and everyone's, oh, my God, whoa, what a shocker. Aren't they intentionally giving them the swerves to help their own cause?
I think they clearly are. I think that's what you have to be prudent and figure out what's actually happening. And if you know the team really well and you know how they draft and you know how they think, then you can tell what's a bluff and what's actually going to happen. And I think you have to be very cognizant of the teams in the National Football League, and you've got to know their strengths and weaknesses. And even though you're hearing sounds coming out of their building that this may happen, you really tend to believe they're just trying to either enhance their pick by trading down or they're trying to get somebody not to draft somebody that they really want.
So what are the incentives for using the media to help your pick? To drive up interest in a player
that you think someone else wants? Like, I think Kansas City is sitting there at 5, and I think they clearly would like to trade back a little bit. I think they want to drum up some interest in their pick, so I think they'll send out some signals that they may go in the quarterback direction, which they can't do. They may go in another direct defensive end position, which they can't do. I think they're trying to entice people to come up and hopefully, you know, have an auction. Clearly with the Jets and the Patriots, the two teams that love one another right behind them, they're trying to create some competition and figuring that they can be the beneficiaries of that. And I think that's what happens. And I think you have to be very cognizant of what's actually going on in front of you, and you can't react to one story, and you've got to really realize how people draft and understand it.
So you make a consensus decision. Let's pretend we're going to take Matt Ryan and that we think he could be a potential 10-time All-Pro, and let's start leaking that out, and that's going to be our guy, and then eventually the Jets or the Pats will panic.
Right.
And then you hopefully one of them
Maybe Baltimore will panic and Baltimore will come up and get them. You're just trying to drum up some business, and you do it through all different ways. You might have your video guy leak it out. You know, the video guy tells another video guy, hey, I hear we're in love with Matt Ryan, and the next thing you know, the video guys are talking, and then that information gets to the general manager, and hey, I heard Kansas City really wants to draft Matt Ryan. Well, it could be a bad story, and I think you have to be really careful of what's misinformation as opposed to what is actually information.
With the Patriots, though, they have no leaks. In fact, people get killed if there's a leak. They actually take them behind the stadium and they shoot them. But the Jets seem like the Jets are a little bit of a rockier ship, because I'm not sure if that coach is there after this year, if they have another bad season. So I could see them, the leaks potentially getting out there. But how would the Jets and the Patriots know who the other team likes when they hate each other so much?
Well, they have, you know, people that are in the building, know everybody up there, and I think there's reactionary inferences that happens. And so, like, if an assistant coach who was at New England still has friends up in New England, even though he's been ostracized to the Jets, there still may be conversations. And I think really deeper than that is the fact that, you know, Eric knows exactly how Bill thinks, and Bill will know how Eric's going to think. And Bill's so smart, and he'll be able to predict exactly which direction they're going to go. And by the moves that you made this offseason, lends you to also think where they're going to head.
How many people in a war room or a brain trust, what's the fewest number of people that you could have that would know what a team's going to do?
I would think, you know, in Cleveland, we really scaled it back, because it was a situation where you have too many people and too many voices, and you're not getting the right information. And I think in New England, and I've never been in their draft room, but I would suspect that there's probably only three or four people in that room.
And the owner, who would those people be?
I would suspect it would be Belichick, Pioli, maybe the director of college scouting. I know he left to go to the Falcons, but maybe Larry. They brought in another scout to come in and help out, so maybe they'll have a scout in there, and the owner, and maybe the pro personnel director to discuss teams. But it'll be very minimum, and I don't even think any of the scouts will be in the room, because they don't want to have misinformation, because it's ultimately, there's a layering effect in New England. There's a group of people that collect information to take that information to another group of people who then take it to the Belichick and Pioli, and then they make the decisions. And so there's clearly a layering, and when you have that layering, you really don't know what's happening at the top, because it's like having, you know, three shooters and only one guy has the real bullet. You really don't know what they're going to do.
The owner, you mentioned that the owner is in there. For some reason, this makes me laugh that Bob Kraft would just be sitting in on all these meetings about, you know, like he has any idea who would make a good player or who not.
Sometimes, Bill, I think sometimes people from the outside can actually ask good questions, and I think it forces you to give good answers, and it also entices you to make the right decisions. I'm not saying Bob Kraft's going to know what the right tackle is going to do on every play, or what his set is, and what is, but he may ask the right question. And when you've got this much of an investment in him, I think sometimes those questions cause you to think and cause you to answer some things that you're not sure of. And when you do, I heard Donnie Walsh say this the other day on TV Knicks press conference, and it was a great point. He said the owners of the Pacers never really asked him about a decision or told him not to do something. They just asked him, and then the way he answered it to them made him believe if he really believed it or if he didn't believe it. And I think there's a checks and balances there that's very good, and I thought Donnie Walsh put it extremely well in there. And he said, when I didn't sell it very hard to the owners of the Pacers, then I knew my heart really wasn't in it. But when I was emphatic and they let me do it, because they were going to let me do it anyway, I knew I was making the right move. And I think that's why an owner's in there. They're playing devil's advocate. It's much like Churchill had a devil's advocate cabinet. And, you know, just to give some perspective different than what you're going to hear. Because if you're in there just rubber stamping anything, if everybody's thinking alike, nobody's thinking.
Wait, you just made the case for my VP of common sense thing.
I think you have a great point. I think you should be. I think everybody should put you on retainer. I think it's clearly the case. I mean, I think you make great valid points. In fact, your dad should be a scout because he obviously watched all the Boston College games and he knows.
Yeah, I told you. My dad is down on Matt Ryan. My dad watches pretty much every BC game and just thought he was too erratic. He didn't see how he could just go right in the NFL and make plays.
Well, I think he's not going to go right in the NFL, make plays. However, I think he gives you a chance a year from now to make plays. And I think a lot of the things we have to do with scouts and personnel people is we have to project out a year from now. I think that's the best scout is the scout that can project and look at a player and say, you know what, he's really going to be a good player if we can do this, this, and this. If they're already ready-made players, then all you're doing is grading their production, and they're not going to get any better. And I think there's an element where if you think you can improve it, and sometimes there's certain qualities a player has, for example, quarterback's accuracy, very difficult to improve. If you can't improve it, then the player won't ever make it.
Yeah, the QB thing, I've written about this a million times, but at some point, you're winning in college should matter at least a little bit, right?
I think that's Matt Ryan's case. I think take Alex Smith from Utah. If you put Alex Smith, the first round pick of the San Francisco 49ers, and I don't mean to diss on Alex Smith, but if you put him at Boston College, would he have the kind of career that Matt Ryan had? I don't think he would. And Alex Smith is the first pick overall in the draft. And everybody's down on Matt Ryan, and he may slip to 7. He may even go to 8 in this draft. And I think it's being a little bit unfair. I think what Matt Ryan has done in Boston College and what he's been able to accomplish deserves a lot of credit.
The one thing my dad did say about Matt Ryan is he had a knack for not being good and then somehow rallying and becoming good in the fourth quarter, which is a quality you want in a QB.
I think that's clearly the case. I think that's really something that's important. You know, I used to, you know, you're a Celtic fan, and you never wanted Bird to shoot bad in the first quarter because you knew in the fourth quarter he wouldn't miss a shot. You know,
right.
You wanted him to hit everything in the first quarter and get a 10-point lead because you'd pray in the fourth quarter he wouldn't make anything. And I think that's a lot about quarterbacks. Quarterbacks get knocked on their butt, and they're the ones that get back up and make plays. And I think really that's the essence of a great player. And, you know, Rich Gannon was that way. He may struggle early, and then all of a sudden the fourth quarter he could lead us back when I was with Oakland. And Montana was the same way. And I think there's something to it.
Back to the owners and your stint in Oakland. Was Al Davis heavily involved in your drafts?
He ran every draft, and he'll run this draft.
He ran it?
He runs the draft. That's his baby.
Really?
He runs the draft. He enjoys it. He's a player personnel expert. He wants to run the draft. Everything is done through his chair. He signs off on every single pick, and that's the way we all do it. Now, everybody has a voice and everybody has an opinion, but obviously it's all weighted upon what he actually wants to do.
Would you say that every team has a single voice? Is there anybody where there's two voices or three voices and those guys kind of hash it out?
I think there's some teams that have that committee mentality, and I think that's why they make some mistakes. And I think the worst thing about the committee mentality is even though you turn the card in, the two people that didn't want the card turned in all leave the building and say, I really didn't want to pick the guy. And that creates dissensions in an organization.
Right.
And I think when you have the smaller amount of people that are in the draft room, the better off it is. And I really believe this. I tell a story one time. I was at Washington State, and a scout from the Philadelphia Eagles and I were sitting next to each other. And it was 1985. And I said to the guy, I'd come off of UNLV, and I said, boy, that was a great pick at Randall Cunningham. And this area scout said to me, oh, it's the worst pick of all time. We should have never done it. We should have picked Darren Gilbert, an offensive tackle from Cal State Fullerton. It was a much better pick. They should have done it. It's ridiculous. The dumbest thing we've ever done. 7 years later, I'm running the scouting department in Cleveland. I get a letter from that area scout saying that he was responsible for picking Randall Cunningham.
Oh.
So he must have thought I forgot the conversation. However, but that's the point. I think what happens is nobody wants to ever, you know, wants to be on the right side of the law.
Yeah, he probably forgot about your fantastic long-term memory. It is amazing to me that you can remember stuff that vividly that happened in 1985, because I can't remember what I did 3 weeks ago.
Well, Well, you know, I lived it. It's part of, you know, it's part of my life, and I can remember pretty much every day that I worked for Bill Walsh and what we did. And there's, you know, Bill Walsh is like a father to me. You know, he's no longer on this earth, but his voice still resonates in my ear. And things that I do today, I think of, God, he said that to me back in 1985 and 86. And, you know, that draft that we had in 86, I can remember every single pick, and I can remember every single player that we were thinking about. And I can remember where we were standing in the room, because it was like I knew we were doing something special. And we were able to make those picks, and he did it, and he did it all by himself. And when he got frustrated is when he got up out of the chair, and we picked Don Griffin in the sixth round. And you know, that draft obviously is probably one of the best drafts in the history of sports.
I can only imagine how exciting it is if you have a draft go your way, because I know in fantasy, when I have a fantasy draft go my way, I'm on a high for 3 weeks. So if it happened in real life, I think it would last like 5 years.
Yeah, and then when you have one that doesn't go your way, and I've had a few of those, you burn your clothes when you get home. You want to see them.
What was your least favorite draft that you had?
I think probably the one that I wake up today still with is 1995, 96. We were in Cleveland together, and we had the 10th pick, I believe. And there was 10 really good players in the draft. We got some information on one player, Warren Sapp, that wasn't favorable. It wasn't accurate, but we tend to believe it. And when the Jets picked Kyle Brady in front of us, everybody thought we were going berserk, which we would have picked Brady clearly at that pick. However, that pick, you know, we would have easily picked Warren Sapp the next pick, but we had some wrong information about Warren, and he went two picks later. We traded down to the bottom of the first round. We're going to pick Curtis Martin there, but thought, no, we should just go ahead and pick. We'll sign Lorenzo White in free agency. We sign Lorenzo White, and we'll pick a defensive player. And then the rest of that day, everything. And when I got home that night, I burned every the clothes that were on my body. So, you know, those are the ones that you remember. And I think the only way you learn and the only way you get better in this industry is to remember the mistakes.
You know, you did that Cleveland draft with Belichick. And one of the most interesting things I've ever read about him is how he handles the draft. If somebody that works for him is like so passionate about a specific prospect that, you know, you could just see it in their eyes, he'll actually consider taking that guy, and that's how they ended up with Tom Brady.
I think there's no doubt. He's going to go with a belief, but you have to be, with Bill, you've got to be very strong in your conviction, because he's a great defense attorney, and he can turn the witness around completely if you're not strong with what your case is. You know, if you go in very lukewarm and say, you know, I really like this guy, and then he starts asking you questions, well, I really don't like him, he's got you. And then the tragedy of the situation is going to be he's never going to listen to you again.
Yeah.
And that's what happens to him. And most scouts tend to get intimidated by his knowledge and his intelligence, and they back away from him, and they don't feel like they're going to be able to stand it. And the ones that do are the ones he's going to listen to.
You know, you mentioned how there was 10 good players in that draft that you guys screwed up. And this year it seems like there's a consensus top 7. And then after that it drops a little. I'm a big believer in tiers in drafts in general. I think especially in the NBA. If you just do it by the tiers and you're in the last spot of one of those tiers and you can get one of those guys, you should probably take the guy. With the Patriots, it seems like it's 7-player draft. They have the 7th pick. Do they just take the best guy, or do they go by need? Like, what do you think they're going to do with that pick?
I think they're going to sit down and analyze that whomever they pick has to be able, they're going to probably pay him more than they gave Tom Brady, which is going to concern them. And I think it's going to bother them very much. And I think they're going to sit in the room and discuss the position that least will impact having to pay this much money. And I think it'll lead them to offensive or defensive linemen. I think if Glenn Dorsey were to make it to 7, it's a slam dunk. I think if Glenn Dorsey was a guy that they could trade up to get, if they actually could, I think that it would be somebody that they would be enticed about. I don't believe it would be Cedric Ellis. I think it would be an offensive lineman. That's just my gut feeling on what I think Bill will do, because Bill has a great ability to see a player project to the future. And offensive linemen, even though people say, oh, how could you pick them? Remember, two offensive linemen this year, Max Starks and Stacy and Andrews from the Cincinnati Bengals, both were backups and both got designated and couldn't leave their teams because of free agency. So offensive linemen are extremely valuable. And when you have those, you know, it's a great commodity. And when teams are designating backup offensive linemen as franchise players, that tells you all you need to know about linemen.
Look, you're talking to a guy who rooted for a team that had a chance to go 19-0 and didn't because they couldn't block the Giants for 4 quarters.
Right.
So I am well aware of offensive linemen. And, in fact, I have never, not only have I never been less excited for a draft that my team had a high pick in, but this season could really start 3 years from now and I'd be okay with it.
Like, well, they take a while to get over. You put so much into it. I think
especially last year.
You know, I don't think there's ever going to be a time in my life that the Tuck game's ever going to walk away from me. And there's other games that happen, but the Tuck game obviously resonates in my life, and you know, and I'm sure it does in yours in a positive vein. But for me, you know, those are things that you put in your life. But I really think the essence to understand about that Super Bowl was the fact that when you have a dominant defensive line and you can protect it with an offensive line, you can win a Super Bowl if you've got quarterback play.
Right.
And it doesn't matter what you have at the other positions. I mean, people talk about taking Darren McFadden, and he'll make a difference. Minnesota Vikings had the number one ranked run defense and run offense in the league, and they watched the playoffs.
I think the thing that hurt about the Super Bowl was that the Patriots were built the way you just described. They could rush the passer, they could protect the QB, and they had a QB who could make plays. So on paper, they had the perfect type of team, but what we didn't realize was that, you know, I don't know if the offensive line just wasn't talented enough or if they were – part of me just feels like they were just burned out from basically playing the Super Bowl every week from week eight on. I just didn't seem like they were enjoying it that much. I don't think the coach was enjoying it. I don't think the players were enjoying it. And to me, the team seemed grim in the playoffs, and they seemed grim in the Super Bowl. Would you agree with that?
You know, funny you said that, because while I was with Denver this year helping Mike out, Shanahan and I were talking as the Patriots were going along, and they lost a game to the Giants that year that they went 15-1 and ended up winning the Super Bowl. And he thought that game was the best thing that ever happened to him.
Really?
Losing the Giants, because it kind of lifted that cloud off of him.
Mm.
And it made him feel like, now, okay, we can refocus and rededicate. You know, you're chasing immortality, and it's tough. I mean, ask Tiger. It's not an easy thing to do. And, you know, and it's very difficult when you're out there and you're trying every week as your Super Bowl. And these teams are so evenly matched that it's difficult to bring your A game all the time. Now, I'm not sure that Tom was 100% healthy in that game at quarterback.
Or 80.
Yeah. So I think that made a slight difference. But take nothing away from the Giants. They peaked at the right time. They were very good.
No, they did everything they had to do to win the game. Brady was terrible, though. I mean, really. I'd be hard-pressed to remember a worse game that he played for the first three quarters than that game. But do you think, you know, the whole Spygate thing, I guess it's finally going away. It seems like people are starting to realize that maybe this Matt Walsh isn't the greatest source.
I think it's interesting in baseball that they steal signals and everybody says it's okay. And in football, it requires Alan Spector to get involved. I think it's kind of overblown.
Yeah.
And I think it's really not a story. I think they're a really talented team in New England. I think they've built some really good teams in New England. And I don't think they've had to compromise anything to win those Super Bowls. And I think if somebody's willing to put their signals out on the field and show it to somebody, and they're not covering them up, then they deserve to get them stolen.
Well, you worked with Belichick in Cleveland, so you know he's somebody that you do care about. Do you? And this is somebody that here's the thing that's amazing to me about Spygate. He's somebody that actually did care about his legacy, and he's a big history buff. And I think out of all the coaches that this could have happened to, I think he's the one who understands the significance of it the most.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that he recovers from this? Like, how much do you think this has affected him over the past 9 months?
I think I learned a lot from Bill, but I think the one thing I learned more than anything from Bill was his ability to focus on the task at hand and not worry about things he couldn't control.
Mm.
And I really think he's one of those people that can, I think Stephen Covey should go to him, the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, and use him as a model. He can clearly work on what is urgent and what is important and leave everything else aside. And he does it brilliantly, and he doesn't let other outside distraction, almost Tiger Woods-ish in terms of letting anybody bother him. He can focus on the task at hand better than anybody I know.
And you think the team kind of follows that lead a little bit?
I think all teams become who their head coach is. I think their personalities are reflective into the teams. I don't think it can help. You know, you're standing in front of the team from the middle of July to the end of December, and, you know, the players are going to reflect your personality, and I think they do. You know,
does that explain the 2006 Raiders?
No, there I'm not going, but, you know.
I'll let you off the hook on Art. Who would you know, it's tough to answer this question because we haven't had the draft yet, and there's still some chips that need to fall, but Do you think the Patriots still the prohibitive favorite for 2008, or do you see somebody else maybe supplanting them?
No, I think clearly they're the favorite. I think they're so talented and they can beat you so many different ways. And that's the hard part when you play a Bill Belichick team is he makes you play left-handed and see if you can win. And if you make him play left-handed, he can beat you. And I think there's not a lot of versatile enough teams to be able to play a style that's going to be conducive to beating him. Now, when it gets into the playoffs, maybe something bad could happen. I think San Diego clearly would be the competitor right now, and they're going to have to prove that they can stay healthy and do all the things. But right now in the AFC, I think those two teams clearly are above everybody else. The Giants have a tough task at hand because coming off of a Super Bowl year, it's going to be very difficult. Now, I say that, and usually every team that loses the Super Bowl has those Super Bowl blues and blahs, and I don't see that coming for New England.
Give me your top seven for this draft and how you think it's going to go with the top seven teams, and who do you think is the most likely to trade out of one of those spots?
Well, I think Kansas City's clearly trying to trade. I think obviously Miami would like to trade. I don't know if they're going to be able to. The money is so great. It's a little bit like the NBA, and you write a lot about this, and I'm not blowing smoke, but you learn a lot from the way you approach it. But a team is going to have to almost trade something to get away from the first pick, get something. A little bit like
NBA. Almost like getting rid of a big contract in
exactly.
the NBA.
Exactly. You're going to have to give up something to get it if you want it. I think that's where we're headed in the National Football League.
But I
think the best player in the draft is Glenn Dorsey. And he's not going to go first because he doesn't seem to fit Miami's style of defense. But I would throw caution into the wind here, and I don't think the Dolphins will do this, but I think Glenn Dorsey could make enough of a difference as a nickel rusher on second and third down in a four-man line, because no matter what your front, through 34 or 43, you're going to play a four-man line on third down or second down, and your nickel groups are all four-man lines. I think he could make enough of an impact in that role to justify being the first pick, but I don't think he will. I think he's clearly one of the top players in the draft, and I think he's going to go, and I think there'll be three offensive linemen potentially picked in the top seven. I really believe the Ryan Clandy kid from Boise State's a very talented left tackle. He's a legitimate left tackle. Jake Long could play left tackle. I believe he's probably better suited at right tackle. And Brandon Albert is an immensely talented player from the University of Virginia who can play all the line positions, maybe even center. And I put him for New England last week when I did a mock draft, and I thought he would go there. But I think those players, those offensive linemen, and of course the defensive line, Vernon Golston, I think has got some miss to him in the sense that he just doesn't really do it all the time. And I think a lot of the sacks he gets in college are against running backs in there, and he's not going to have that luxury in the National Football League.
What a crazy, crazy turn of events that not only did your team stink, but the one good thing that happened to you is that you ended up with a top five pick. But even that's a bad thing.
Now
so you're just going to stink perpetually.
Well, it's very difficult until the Raiders get the, we made this mistake and I was included in it. When you don't have a transitional way to go from a great quarterback to another great quarterback, you're going to take some time. And I think if you look at all the great teams in the National Football League, the passing of the baton from quarterback to the next quarterback, if it's not smooth, it's going to cost people their jobs. It's going to cost everybody years on the season, and it's going to be hard to recover. We go back to the 2004 draft. Rich Gannon was coming back. We thought he was going to be healthy. We passed Ben Roethlisberger. We passed Phillip Rivers. We took Robert Gallery, who we all felt was the right pick at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, 3 years later, we're picking a quarterback. 2006, we passed Matt Leinart. We passed Jay Cutler to pick a safety. So until you address the quarterback, and I think Cleveland should be the poster child for this. Cleveland's team really didn't change other than they got good quarterback play and they won 10 games. But everybody had them as the worst team in the National Football League before they got good quarterback play.
I've been making this case for 5-6 years, and now it seems like a lot of people are making it. What would stop a team from just not handing in a card?
Nothing. It would actually make the draft go faster because the team behind them would hand in a card, and the team behind them would hand in a card, and the team behind them. It happened in Minnesota when Minnesota didn't want to pay, and that's when all of a sudden it starts, and then people just start handing cards in.
Because let's say Miami wants Jake Long, and let's say they don't think that any of the next three teams would take him. So why wouldn't they just not pass him the card?
Well, because the argument that they would have would be that, you know, Jake Long, you know, that agent would come in and say, Jake Long deserved to be the second pick. You just were too late getting a card, and you had, and probably would try to get somebody in the room saying you were too confused to do it and hopefully get paid that. And that's why Brian McKinney lasted for so long, and he held out to almost the ninth or tenth game of the season.
So the lesson, as always, is that agents are just evil.
Yeah, pretty much so, unless they represent Bill Simmons.
I don't have an agent. All right, let's do the top seven quick. So Miami, number one.
I think Miami goes with Jake Long.
Okay. St. Louis, number two.
I think, you know, I've had him picking Chris Long here, but I'm going to change that a little bit, and I'm going to have him pick Glenn Dorsey here.
Man, I don't follow college football enough to really have an educated, you know, opinion that I feel 100% about. But everything I read about Glenn Dorsey last season and with the draft, he just seems like the sure thing to me out of all these guys.
I think
you know what you're getting.
He's the best player in the draft. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
This is a guy who, he was on the best team. He was double-teamed the whole season. Like, what more does the guy have to do?
Well, and I think that's another Belichickian strength, is he's only going to watch games against equal competition. I think, you know, you start talking to scouts and you listen to people on these networks talking about how much tape they're watching. Mm. Ultimately, it's really, if you're going to watch, you know, do you really want to watch Glenn Dorsey against Vanderbilt? Because that Vanderbilt guard, all due respect to Vanderbilt, is probably not going to play in the National Football League. But the offensive guard at Auburn might, you know. So you got to be real careful and real tactical at who you're watching and who you're watching them against.
Atlanta, number three.
I think if Dorsey's not on the board, they go Matt Ryan.
Hmm. That's a lot of pressure for him.
Yeah. But I don't think Atlanta has an alternative here. Atlanta has to get the quarterback thing fixed. They're going to have to move in a direction to get some things going. You know, the key to the Atlanta draft isn't going to be that third pick. It's going to be the three twos that they have. They've got to make those into three starters.
I think Atlanta should just take a season off, like when a restaurant renovates, and just put a sign up, like, we'll be back in 2009. Just forfeit their games and regroup, and then they come back a year from that. What do you think?
I think it might work.
Number four, Oakland.
I think it's Vernon Golston. They need a defensive end. They need somebody that kind of push, get some pass rush in the bottom quarter of the league and sacks last year. And now that they've got, supposedly they have two shutdown corners in D'Angelo Hall and Asamoah, they think that if they can get some pass rush.
Supposedly. I like how you snuck that one in.
I know Asamoah is certainly a shutdown corner.
Yeah, you're not as high on D'Angelo Hall, huh?
I didn't say that. I just said I know one of them is.
You said supposedly. Number five, let's assume that KC trades this pick. Who goes in this spot?
I don't think KC, if this the way the board I gave you is there, I think KC's stuck with the pick. I don't think anybody's going to trade up to get anybody from here on out. I think McFadden is people are not going to trade up to get McFadden. So that would be the only player that would be enticing enough to be trading up to get. And I think Kansas City, if Ryan and Dorsey are gone, and Golston are gone, I think that this clearly becomes Kansas City's going to have to make the pick.
So who's the pick?
Jake Long.
Didn't we have Jake Long go already?
No, I had Jake Long going to the – no, I'm sorry, not Jake Long. I believe they'll take here. They'll take Ryan Clandy.
Right. Okay. Wow, so they're stuck with the fifth pick and they're stuck with Herm Edwards. That's a bad combo. Right. Number six, the New York Jets.
I think the New York Jets obviously will look long and hard at Chris Long here.
Hmm.
Gives them an outside rusher to go along with Calvin Pace. They obviously, the quarterback's off the board. I don't believe McFadden's the right investment for them, and I think Chris Long would be the pick here.
I agree with you. They just paid all that money to Thomas Jones, and McFadden is like the reactionary New York move that New York teams always seem to make but isn't necessarily the right pick.
Mm-hmm.
Number seven, my New England Patriots.
I think they take Brandon Albert, the offensive tackle guard. I think they play him there, and they get a four-dimensional player, can play anywhere in the line, and it gives them a legitimate left tackle if they want to move Matt Light inside. You know, Matt's always had a little trouble with playing against linear guys, and his short arms do affect him at times, and I think if they can get this kid and kick him out, I think the best investment you can make in the top 10 is pick a left tackle, and this kid could play left tackle.
How have your short arms affected you over the years?
They've killed me. In fact, I've had a double pump on every shot I've made in basketball. I've never gone straight up for the shot.
I actually think you're wrong with the Pats. I think there is a 100% chance that they either trade down, and if they can't trade down, I think they're the first team to successfully pull the card trick for like 20 spots. I could just see Belichick with his guy, one of his minions, just standing next to the podium, like just waiting, like a marathon sprinter starting to run, and just waiting and waiting and waiting. And then, like, pick 20. He's going to charge up there and give the card. That's my prediction. Trade down or the marathon sprinter.
Well, we have to do this again so we can see if your prediction's right.
After the draft, you're coming back on. So, wait, one last question. Where does McFadden go?
I think I had McFadden go into the Cincinnati Bengals, and I'll stand by it. I think that that's the right pick for them. I think that, you know, you have to understand that organization. They do like offense, and their running back last year averaged 2.9 per carry.
He's washed up.
And so they need a back. And defensively, they only gave up 17.3 points in the last eight games, and I think they've got to fix that.
It's the right pick.
Fix the running game.
It's the right pick for them on paper, but is it the right pick for society?
Well, we have to do a lot of homework on them.
I mean, didn't they learn anything from what happened to the Portland Trailblazers these last 2 years? Like, fans would rather go 500 with a group of good guys than make the playoffs and lose in round one with a group of guys that aren't maybe good guys.
I don't think the Bengals have subscribed to the NBA ticket.
No. I really thought Portland was going to alter. Well, I guess there are more bad guys in football, potential bad pick character guys than in basketball. In basketball, you're a little more naked. It's a little more obvious. In football, you're wearing equipment. There's so many guys in the team. Maybe you could take more chances with some. Would you agree with that or no?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and plus the team can help. I think, you know, it's like we talk about corners. You know, if you take a corner that doesn't tackle very well, if you have a huddle with Ray Lewis in the huddle, Ray Lewis will get that kid to tackle. I learned that at the 49ers. You know, we took Tim McKeyer in 1986, and you know, we knew that Ronnie Lott in the huddle, that Tim McKeyer would tackle.
Yeah. Well, I guess the biggest difference in the NBA is in the NFL is if you take Darren McFadden in the NBA and he doesn't work and he turns out to be a bad guy, you're screwed for like 4 years.
Right.
But in the NFL, you can kind of bounce back potentially a year from that. So maybe it's
and they'll protect themselves with the contract. That's the beautiful thing with McFadden is because of his past, he's going to have to protect himself with the team that drafts him with his contract. And so you'll lose the pick, but you won't be as exposed as much on the money like in the NBA.
I will say this as a Patriots fan, a member of the AFC, it would scare me if the Bengals got McFadden. Carson Palmer. I mean, yeah. Ugh.
That would give them, it gives them a little punch. And plus, you know, you have to remember, it's key to have a back that can get the short yardage plays.
Yeah.
And that's the number one thing when you watch playoff football is who's converting the thirds and ones. And Jerome Bettis did it, which gave Pittsburgh their Super Bowl. And I think that's what's got to happen.
Did you think Peterson was going to be as good as he was last year?
I didn't think Peterson would stay as healthy as he was, as he did last year. I thought that was always going to be a knock. I think he's obviously a really talented player, but his durability, even though he did get hurt a little bit, surprised me.
All right, Mike Lombardi.
Right,
We'll have you after the draft. You
please
can give us a little report card.
Please, and I need to have the sports gal critique my column, please.
I would love to do that. And also, next time we got to discuss the fade to black ending of The Sopranos, because I know you want America to hear your thoughts on that.
All right, buddy. Thanks.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Complex Litigation, this is John.
Jenny!
Hey there.
What's going on?
Not too much. What's going on with you?
You know, getting ready for the NFL draft. Excited by the two big Red Sox wins.
Sure.
Excited by the complete collapse of the Yankees starting rotation.
Oh, come on. That's really strong. Bill Hughes has not been great, but...
Ian Kennedy hasn't been good either.
He pitched well the other night. He's a little shaky.
So you're going to vote well as six innings and 300 runs? That's well for you now?
Yeah, I'll take it. For me and Kennedy, I'll take it. I can't call them the Devil Rays anymore. You described the Rays as scrappy.
Yeah, they are a little scrappy.
So there you go.
They're a little scrappy. Unfortunately for the Red Sox, the Yankees caught the Rays at the perfect time, right after Al Reyes was tasered and pitched like the next day.
That's exactly right. All we can do is play the games on the schedule, Billy.
Thank God we didn't have tasers when we were in college, because it's a mortal lock that you would have been tasered by somebody.
Odds are good, yes. Indeed.
Actually, we probably would have owned one.
Yeah, we would have tasered each other.
I think we would have.
That would have been like a competition, absolutely.
It would have been one of those things that if somebody passed out, they got tasered. Johnny, let's talk about this jersey at the bottom of Yankee Stadium that they had to dig up because it was a Red Sox jersey. I mean, you guys are basically, you've become the Red Sox. You're afraid of curses. You're afraid of like these weird karmic things. It's got to be humiliating, right?
Well, I'm glad they dug it up. I think it was good. But it is somewhat pathetic that I was like, when I read about that, I was a little worried. I'm like, oh my God, they buried a jersey there. That can't be a good omen. Like, that's really not good. I know. I'm like two games away from writing a Shaughnessy-esque book about the curse of Mariano Rivera or something, you know. The curse of Kevin Millar. I don't know who cursed us.
It would be the curse of Dave Roberts. Well, actually, right. We go back to 2001, so it would probably be the curse of whoever got that winning hit against Rivera in 2001.
Exactly. Dave DeLucci, or no, Luis Gonzalez, yeah.
Yeah, because if that had happened in 2000...
Yeah.
Yankee fans would have laughed it off, like, oh, the Red Sox, this will be the new curse of the Bambino for you guys.
Exactly.
And instead, the opposite happened, and they had to spend 5 hours digging it up.
Indeed. I'm glad
you can't be happy,
though.
Johnny. You can't be happy as a Yankee fan.
No, it's a rough times. Although, and not only have the roles reversed in that way, but I went to Fenway Park on Friday night and openly wore a Yankees hat and was subjected to not one single taunt. Not any threats of violence, not anybody suggesting what I could do with myself or with my mother. It was really troubling and surprising.
Wow.
I expected there'd be, like, things would be thrown at me or comments. The only comment was from an usher, about a 70-year-old usher, who said, you need to get a new hat. And he had a big smile on his face, like it was in good humor. The Red Sox fan is really soft now. There were two World Series. It's like, I mean, if I'd worn a Yankee hat to a Red Sox-Yankee game in 2003... What are the odds of me getting out there without a black eye?
I don't know if soft is the word I'd use. I'd use indifferent.
Indifferent, yeah. Well,
really?
Above it all, dignified, maybe.
Really, if you wore an Indians hat, I think people would have been more threatened because that's our real obstacle now, the Cleveland Indians. I forgot you were in the league until I was flicking channels last night.
It's really troubling. Has it clunked that low?
It's not good, Johnny.
Jeez, that's really poor. That's really bad. We need to rally here, the Yanks.
It's not good. It really isn't.
I mean, I was feeling good because the Yanks won a game last night, and I was subjected to the scariest words in the English language as I watched the game. Do you know what the scariest words in the English language are?
What are they?
Kyle Farnsworth is getting loose in the Yankee bullpen.
Oh, no.
With a lead. The Yankees had a 5-3 lead, and poor Jabba is with his ailing father, so we were relying on Kyle Farnsworth to get us through the eighth.
Yeah, and then you have to hear about... The Jabba, when does he come back? Is he okay? That's going to be a dominant storyline. And then on top of that, you have no other setup guys, really.
No, the Kyle Farnsworth-Latroy Hawkins duo is not really doing it for me. I'm going to go crazy and say that.
When Latroy Hawkins got beat up in one of his first starts, it was so predictable, I don't even think I called you.
Well, you know, speaking of curses and jerseys, I read in the paper today that Latroy Hawkins is switching his jersey number. Because did you hear about this controversy? They gave him Paul O'Neill's number, number 21. And on opening day, he was booed lustily. And every time he came in, fans would chant, Paul O'Neill, Paul O'Neill, when they saw 21. Latroy got a complex about it, and now he's switching to 22. And you know what former great Yankee wore number 22?
Yes.
That's exactly right.
I will say this, as much as I hate the Yankee fans and think that they should be tortured relentlessly, they are great about supporting their team at the games and doing the little chants. And like somebody like Paul O'Neill, who on a lot of other teams would have just come and gone. Like the fact that they just are keeping his memory alive now,
oh,
I think is funny.
Everybody loves Paul O'Neill,
yeah.
The Warrior. In 1997, when they got eliminated against Cleveland, and he almost broke his arm trying to get into second base to get into scoring position in the ninth inning with two outs. I mean, there was no greater Yankee than Paul O'Neill.
I know, but you could say the same about the Red Sox and Trot Nixon.
True.
But if somebody wore Trot Nixon's number, I don't know if the Red Sox fans chant Trot Nixon's name the whole time.
I think somebody does. Doesn't Nancy Drew wear that? Doesn't he wear Trot Nixon's number 7?
How dare you talk about the hottest center in baseball
Nancy
like
Drew,
that?
That's right.
He's the hottest. He's unbelievable. He's a triple crown threat.
You think Ty Cobb somewhere getting nervous right now?
He's getting a little nervous. He's Rogers.
Rogers Hornsby.
Rogers Hornsby's looking over his shoulder wondering what that noise is.
I just hope if he hits higher than 406, do they change the name of the 406 club at Fenway? Is it Nancy Drew becomes the 410 club or something, you know?
We're talking about it. We're prepared for any scenario.
Jeez, I almost hurt my neck watching Red Sox fans do a 180 on him. God, talk about a turnaround.
We'll turn on him again as soon as he goes like 0-10. Where did you stand on the whole David Ortiz washed up, not washed up thing?
Well, I find it quite intriguing that in the year that they cracked down on steroids that he can't break 100 as a batting average.
Oh,
in the game.
Johnny.
That must just be a crazy coincidence.
Oh, Johnny.
It's funny how these things work out at the same time. I don't know. I'm sure A has nothing to do with B, but the most feared hitter, Mr. Clutch, he finally got on the interstate the other day with two bloop hits to get on to hitting 100, but I don't know. See, he's looking lost up there.
Now you've done it. You made it almost through an entire year of podcasts without really provoking the rage of Red Sox Nation.
Now I've done it. Now you've done it.
Now you've become a villain. Yeah, that's, there are a lot of people who are like, I know he's a Yankee fan, but I enjoy him. Now it's all thrown away.
Now it's gone.
With one thoughtless, unprovoked accusation about one of the great Americans.
Or Dominicans.
Isn't he American now?
The bus. I'm not sure. Maybe.
I feel like he should be.
Yeah, he should be. He's. I mean, I'm sure he's a fine individual. I wish they would dust him off more often and make him eat dirt and not get as comfortable in the plate as he is. But he seems all right, Big Poppy.
I will say this: I am on a scale of 1 to 10 of being concerned. I am a 9.75 about Big Poppy.
Wow.
Because man, he just. It's not that he's. You know, his numbers are bad. Like just watching him, his bat looks slow. He's not doing that crouch anymore. He looks like he's hurt. Like I would, you know, it's one of those things. Like if it came out like, oh, he's been playing with a torn ACL, or oh, he's got arthritis in his knee and he needs to take 2 weeks off. Like nobody would be surprised. That's how bad he looks.
He really looks lost up there.
Yeah.
I mean, the two hits he got the other night that they were cheering about were like bloop hits that were like, you know, just
not good hits.
No, it wasn't like solid up the middle or anything. And I had a bet with a guy at work as to who was going to break 100 first, Big Poppy or Jason Giambi. I think we both lost. So I think we both just threw in the towel on that.
America lost.
America lost that. God.
Giambi's on my fantasy team. He looks washed up.
I'll tell you, and this is another one of those things whenever you hear the stories about, oh, this guy looks so good in the spring, best shape of his life, tearing the cover off the ball. Let's disregard those stories because he's about 1 for 30, I think, to start off the season. So
you know the season ends and it's like the team announced that they decided not to renew so and so's contract or whatever. I think it would be funny if the Yankees announced that right now in mid-April.
Yeah.
The Yankees announced today that they won't be renewing Jason Giambi. Does he have an option or something?
Like, yeah, he can start his farewell tour.
Got it way ahead of time.
I wish they'd bury Jason Giambi's jersey under the dugout. With Jason Giambi in it. Yeah. God, he's pathetic. He's killing him.
You just did a hee-ah, which is an imitation that nobody got except me.
Nobody understood,
but
that was the thing we would say, after like a bad, not that funny joke, it'd say,
We won't get into that.
Never mind.
Let me ask you this. Why don't the Yankees have like that hot hitter on the horizon?
What do you mean? Like in the minors?
The 21-year-old Roy Hobbs. Not Roy Hobbs, I guess that's a bad example, but like one of those, like the guys they overpaid for at the end of the first round and screwed up the draft structure and overpaid for this guy, and now he's like 21, he's hitting 470 in AA, and he might come up. They don't have a guy like that.
No, I mean, they had these pitchers, you know, they had Jabba and Phil Hughes and allegedly Ian Kennedy in the minors, but there's really no hitter on the horizon. There's some guy whose name was bandied about when they were talking about the Santana deal. Some outfielder, you know, Austin, I think it's Austin Jackson or something like that. But I mean, I don't think he's really like lighting it up in any big way down there. You don't hear like these reports, you know, that come up from the farm system about, oh, God, he hit another 450 home run last night, you know. Yeah, I don't know what it's all about. They have this guy at short they brought up who's like good defensively, but he can't really hit. I don't know. It's odd they don't have that. Odd and disappointing and troubling.
After Phil Hughes' struggles, how are you feeling about the non-Santana trade now?
Hideous. It's what I said all winter.
You stuck to your guns.
I did. I wanted to trade him, and I still wish it happened. Even though Santana hasn't really lit it up and got beat by the Brewers the other day, but I would still much prefer him to Phil Hughes not being able to get out of the third inning against the Red Sox the other day. I mean, plus Phil Hughes is a nibbler. He's afraid to throw strikes. I hate that. I hate it so much. Just challenge guys. Throw it down the pike, you know?
Kennedy's like that too.
Kennedy's like a
and Dice
bolt, though, you know. And Dice K too. All these guys are afraid to throw strikes.
Dice and Hughes are—I forget who was the first person who came up with this term—but the power nibblers.
Yeah,
throwing 97, trying to pick the parts of the plate. Just throw it over the plate.
Exactly. Just throw it down. I mean, you know, he's like afraid to throw to like Veritek. It's just throw it down Broadway, Phil. For God's sake, would you please?
I have not been impressed by him since the near no-hitter when he broke his hamstring or whatever he did.
And for the way
first broken hamstring.
For the way everybody talked about him, like he should be like, I mean, he should be like a young Pedro now, you know. These guys that get hyped up and then he doesn't even come close to delivering. I mean, he hasn't come close to being good. He had one good game against Kansas City and even that wasn't that great.
You know, speaking of things we were right about during the winter, I do think you and I were like the only two people who didn't buy into this Tigers thing.
Exactly, yes.
You were more worried about the weight problem on the team and Ordóñez and Cabrera, but neither of us really were that enthralled by what they did.
Both of us said that Dontrell Willis is no good.
Yes.
Even though, I mean, even before he had the worst split ever, did you see what happened to that injury where
he
went out from under him? The thing was ugly.
Yeah, it was
even
bad.
Before then, he was like walking everybody and getting lit up, wasn't he?
Yep. Yeah.
That was almost a case where the pulled hamstring was good for him, got him out of there, you know?
I'm most worried about Cleveland because the Joe Burrowski era mercifully ended in mid-April. I was hoping that that would go on for at least three more months, but Betancourt should be the closer, and he's the best reliever they have, and now he's going to be the closer. And Perez is still a really good setup guy. And I just like that team. I think they have a trade to make. Like
the Red Sox have their number, though. I mean, they've won now five in a row against them. And that, I mean, that Burrowski thing was just, you could see that one coming down the pike, too. I mean, Joe Burrowski cannot be your closer.
Unfortunately, Dave DiLucci running after the game-winning pop-out by Big Poppy, it looked like he was, like, holding a beer. He was going so slow. It's like he was running with, like, a two-third full Miller Lite or something.
And last night I happened to put on the Red Sox game, Jason Veritek looked as bad as you could possibly look on two swings.
Yeah.
And then he freaking corks one to center field. It was unbelievable.
He does that. My buddy Hench, I think, over the last 3 years has sent me 300 different emails claiming Veritek was washed up. And then he would hit a homer within like 5 minutes of the email.
I'll tell you, I hate Jason Veritek, but that was a big home run for them last night. So
they're an interesting spot with him because he's a free agent coming up. And, you know,
I was going to say they almost have to sign
him. It's a Posada thing.
The Red Sox have been surprisingly cold-blooded in recent years. They're not afraid to trade Nomar or send Pedro packing and Johnny Damon. Like, I don't know. That's a tough call. Veritek, the captain with the ridiculous C on his jersey. What do they do about that, you know? They'll have to offer him some token money, and no one else is going to try and sign him, so.
I think it's one of those things where they have to sign him, but we know in advance that it's going to be May next year, and he's going to be hitting 175, and everybody's going to be bummed out.
It's almost like what the Yankees did with Rivera. You're getting rewarded for past greatness rather than future hope for greatness, you know?
Well, Posada's a great example,
too.
They're the same age.
Yeah.
So how are you feeling this week about the Yanks?
I'm like a 2.5. It's still early. It's way early, but I have some concerns.
You know who's not bad is the backup shortstop guy.
No, he's good, Gonzalez.
Yeah.
He's actually good. He's a little good fielder.
He's a little frisky. Yeah, he's a little frisky on the base pass.
Someday they'll move Jeter to first, and he'll probably be the defensive shortstop of the future, I suppose, is what's going to happen.
And by someday, you mean June 10th.
Yeah, right. I mean, probably.
One last question.
Certainly.
And then we'll let you go back to work. A lot of people concerned about your welfare after your attack on CT on the podcast last week. Has he threatened to pepper your sauce?
Thankfully, I went to Boston and my sauce was not peppered.
That's good. So you still have your sauce.
My sauce is unpeppered. Yes, good.
That's excellent. America's going to be happy to know that. Johnny, we will talk to you next week.
Excellent. Very well.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.